Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 46, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. A technical glitch interrupts testing in several states. A new study shows a direct correlation between test scores and food stamps. And an educator says he taught for more than a decade, but he couldn't read or write. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, your students may be hooked on Fortnite, but there's a way you can use that to your advantage. Our guest will explain how. Hello, teaching community. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Russ, how you doing?
Doing great, Nick.
Lissa, how's it going over there?
I'm great. You asked Russ first. You normally ask me first.
Well, I switched it up once, and now I'm confused, and I don't know what
crazy.
I'm...
crazy.
It's ladies first, Nick.
...what I'm doing anymore. Yeah, I guess you're right. You know, is this school year? Are we getting close to the end? Are we about to wrap up?
Yeah, it's like 25 days or something. I think a teacher posted on Facebook last night. I'm not counting, but a teacher posted on Facebook, which I do have mixed feelings about that when teachers post things like that, because I'm like... No, you know, you wouldn't want your OBGYN to be like, only five more deliveries today, bringing some babies.
Full moon's coming. This is going to be rough.
I know. You're like, what?
Well, in the East Coast, they still have to go a little longer, I know, than the folks down here in the South. But either way, it's wrapping up. It seems to be happening just so fast. And we're on episode 46, which means, what are there, like 52 weeks in a year? Is that right? Yeah, 52?
Yes.
So that means we're almost coming up on our...
One-year anniversary.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Isn't that weird?
What do you do for the first year anniversary? Is
of
it
a
paper
podcast?
Or what is that?
Yeah, it's paper. So we'll have to get tickets somewhere, right?
Yeah, there you go. Perfect.
Yeah.
I don't want to go anywhere with y'all.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Barely comfortable being
Thanks for being honest. Yes. I don't even know where to go with that now. Gosh, let's just jump into the teacher's lounge and hear what Lissa has to say.
Did y'all hear about this testing? I don't know, debacle.
Snafu.
How
many states were impacted? Do we know? Mississippi,
I don't know.
Tennessee.
It's like I kept trying to look into it, and I was like, wait, this is not just Tennessee. It's not just Mississippi. Like, whoa.
Tennessee, Mississippi, and I know New York uses the Questar platform as well.
Yeah. So we're talking about Questar, right?
And I thought Minnesota or something like that, but maybe not. Maybe not.
So the people that have no idea what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, there are hundreds of thousands of tests that were being taken. State tests that were truncated due to some kind of glitch where it would not allow them to log on or submit their tests. So these are like, this is like an important test. And so, of course, everybody's thinking, okay, somebody's not doing their job. Let's have their head on a platter. But they're actually looking into it, thinking it was like a cyber attack.
I've heard different things. I heard that like some kids were getting to like question 25 and 25 was already answered. And then they would like try to click on a different answer and it would go back. Like it just seemed to be this
right.
Huge...
And I heard that they would get to the whole end of the thing and hit submit and then it would wipe it and they were like have to start over. So I don't know, but Russ may know more about this. I'm sure we'll hear soon.
I mean,
we'll
only if we
soon.
Had an expert in the
but
world.
I know if there's only somebody. But what I heard was that they like looked at the traffic or something with the. I don't know, something out there like in the world of computers or something. And it was like, wait a minute, this looks like a cyber attack. And so I know Tennessee is looking into it.
Yeah. I mean, so here's the deal. There's two thoughts at play here, right? So certainly it's a travesty. And districts have spent a lot of time and a lot of money over the past few years getting their network infrastructure and also getting enough devices so that they could test these students. And it's pretty, I don't know, it causes a lot of consternation when they go to, they've done everything they can to make sure that it goes well, and then literally no one in the state can test at that moment. And of course, I think it's important that we mention that all these rumors are unproven, right? And so there could be, you know, as far as what happened, and I think that Questar definitely deserves the benefit of the doubt to some degree. But I will say that if I'm getting paid $13 million to do something like in Mississippi, it sure as hell better work. And it didn't. And so for whatever reason, we just can't get this right. And if this were the first time after 3 or 4 years of smooth sailing and testing online, it would be different, but it's not. It just seems like continually, I know at least in Mississippi, like this is seems to be a very, you know, continual thing that one testing platform or another keeps screwing the pooch when it comes time to perform.
Can we say that on a podcast?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Do I need to put an explicit sticker on this
podcast?
Like
I have not heard that since the 90s. Whoa.
You'll find a lot of statements. Just chill out, all right? So anyway, the thing is that I think there is, it's, I, no one knows probably more than me on, you know, than that it is really tough to pull off a technical challenge using software and education and having web-based browsers and all that thing, all that stuff going on. But it just also seems to me that I don't care. You're getting paid a lot of money and you're telling me it's impossible to pull this off. Like Google makes search work and they have 5 nines of reliability. Google search never goes down, right? I just think ultimately you are responsible for making this work and for holding that testing vendor responsible. And I don't understand when they structure these contracts, like, why isn't there a penalty of $1 million every time this happens?
Right.
Right?
Like, why? These are big contracts, are they not?
Huge contracts. Yeah. Like, Mississippi's a $13 million contract. We're one of the smallest states from a testing perspective going on. Yeah. And I'm just telling you, not to mention the money that has been put into devices. You know, in Mississippi, it's tens of millions of dollars at least, but I think probably in the neighborhood of $50 or $60 million, if I had to guess,
right,
has been spent on upgrading network infrastructure, everything to make this stuff work. And whenever it's certainly not the district's responsibility to make sure the bandwidth that they're not getting too to the service, right? They confirmed that they couldn't do that. It just seems to me that, like, you know, what the hell's going on here? Why can't we make this work in this modern day and age? I think that they should have to pay out of the nose for all the lost time.
I agree.
And these kids, some of these kids are going to have to retake a test. And then
right. You had all the proctors that volunteered to be there. That's such an ordeal for schools.
It is. And then you also have, like, you know, supposedly, I had at least two or three folks mention that there were some irregularities about questions being pre-propagated and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it just seems to me, and again, I haven't independently verified that, so I don't know if that's 100% true, but I believe it probably has a shred of truth to it. And it just seems to me like that kind of stuff is inexcusable. Can anyone get this right, please? Can I pay somebody tens of millions of dollars and have them get this right?
Yeah.
And you
what
know,
if school
seems,
status starts issuing tests? What if y'all become a testing?
Russ's developer will quit.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real tough technical challenge and it's very high stakes, but it's like big boy money, big boy problems. You got paid the money. I don't care if China came and tried to hack into your network. You should have some tolerance built in to making sure that that doesn't happen. And, you know, turn off your traffic to anybody but the United States, or, you know, there's just some measures you can do. It seems to me it's just a lack of load testing. They're not ready for this many students to click.
That's probably it.
At the same time.
Yeah. Well, it's a story we're going to follow for sure. Russ, you and I both have stories that are, I'm going to say heartbreaking, and I'm not trying to bring things down here, but like they're both really interesting stories. So let's have a contest to see who pulls on the heartstrings more. Yes.
Well, my story is about food insecurity. And so I want to share a few statistics about this first. First of all, 1 in 6 U.S. children live in a household, that's 18%, live in a household that is food insecure at some point throughout the year. And think about that for a second. If you walk into a classroom of 30 kids, then 5 of them are going to be living in a household that at some point in the year, they do not know where their next meal is going to come from.
Right.
The genesis of this came from an article in Chalkbeat that basically was talking about students' test scores rise after folks get food stamps for a few weeks. And so It was a really great article, and it was talking about the American Educational Research Journal that looked in North Carolina, and they looked at SNAP, which are really food stamps. And they were just looking at students' test scores on their statewide assessment, their benchmark assessments. And what they found is that after 3 weeks of being on food stamps, the children's test scores that that were in this study, it spiked. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think that that is, it's heartbreaking to me that essentially there's also now a learning component to this that, and it makes sense that children who are hungry and are having hunger pains are unable to focus on assessments in a way that is, you know, it makes a marked difference that's noticeable and studyable. And I don't know, I just saw this and I immediately want to champion some cause,
right?
But it's such a huge gargantuan issue. Like, how do you get your arms around this? What do you guys think?
Well, I know that lots of communities try to help with backpack meals that go home over the weekends, which is great. But again, that also doesn't feed the entire family, and you never know how much of that has to be shared. It's devastating, and it is, you know, I don't know how to fix it, you know, because like you said, it's such a big, big ordeal. But of course, it's going to trickulate into the classroom, into state testing, you know, or performance. Because I mean, I would imagine a great deal of depression goes along with that anxiety for a child. I know a lot of schools around here have started share tables. And basically what that is if you have a school lunch or a home lunch, and there's something that you don't want that's on your tray,
don't throw it away.
You go put it on the share table. Everybody, that's, you just willingly go put it on the share table. And then anyone is allowed to go to the share table and grab, even if they're not going to eat it right then, they may eat it later. And, you know, I feel like if your school does not have a share table, you need to be the person that starts that, right? Because I think about my own child. And I know that I probably pack way too much for him, but he's always hungry at home. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, you know, when you have 25 minutes to eat, I don't know that he eats at all.
Right.
But I know that if there was a share table, he would, you know, with his kind spirit, he would go put stuff on there on purpose.
I mean, what hit home for me is I've always suspected, had a hypothesis that this was an issue, but like, this is research. This is a study that's actually backing it up and just really drives it home for me in two ways. You know, one, that the food can't affect the test scores, and two, that we're in America and you still have all these kids who just aren't being fed properly. So
I also wanted to mention something else, because my mother, I'm a mama's boy. My mother will get on to me if I don't mention this. She actually owns a 501c3 charity, or is it 501c3? So it's a 501c3 charity. It's called Backpack Buddies of Poplarville. And that's my hometown. It's where I'm from, but they help with food insecurity. And they put food in the backpacks of children in my home school district and in the Pearl River County area. I think it's a great charity, and I only bring it up to say that if these programs are not terribly difficult to start, it was literally a group of folks that read how big of a problem this is, and they went and bought food, and they worked with the schools to figure out who the kids that are probably food insecure are. Mm-hmm. And they just quietly on Friday slip it into their backpack. And it's, you know, it's nabs, it's grits that are, you know, it's stuff that you can make single servings that are self-contained, that a child can quickly make. But they started doing it overnight. And now I forgot how many children it is, but I think it's getting close to like 700 or 800 kids. I just think it's something that anyone could do. Like, we all often talk about, you know, the purpose of this podcast when we started was to pass along advice that anyone could do. Mm-hmm. This is something that if you are concerned about this issue in your school district, you can do this today.
All right, so my turn. Have you heard about the teacher? This story just hit the BBC, and it's a teacher who taught for 17 years, but he couldn't read or write.
No.
How is that possible?
I'm not going to tell every detail of the story. I'm going to put it in the show notes and encourage everybody to go read it, because it's a good read. Like, it's really interesting. And he goes through the whole process. He grew up in New Mexico in the U.S. back in like the 1940s and 50s, and he was one of six siblings. But he tells the whole story about how you know, he was in elementary school and everything he was looking at looked like Chinese, and he just couldn't learn and didn't really ask for help. And teacher parent conferences, they'd say, well, he's a smart boy, and they'd move him on to the third grade and fourth grade and so forth. And then he eventually got into high school and he learned that, you know, even though he couldn't read, he still kind of worked the system. He was a very good kid. He always, you know, kind of brown nosed with the teachers, you know, got on their side, and he found that he could kind of work the system that way.
Like social promotion, is that what you're
talking about? And then he got into college, and he said it got a lot harder. He went in on a football scholarship, but he still had to like pass these tests. He talked about how he started to have to cheat, and it actually got worse and worse, where he was like passing blue books outside the window to like another student who would help fill them out, and he would return favors for him. Went so far as he broke into an office in the middle of the night, stole a file cabinet of a teacher, had a locksmith open it, then went and put the file cabinet back. Like it's just this crazy story of this tangled web that he decided to weave. And then he got out of college, and there was a teacher shortage, and he applied for a teacher position, and he got it. And so then he was a teacher, and he found the smartest kids in the class, always made them student aides to help him out with stuff. He said they watched a lot of movies, had a lot of discussions. He taught typing, he taught, you know, gym and stuff like that. And he said he could type 65 words a minute looking at a paper, but he didn't know what he was typing. Go ahead.
So he could type papers, but he didn't know what he was typing. Like, was he?
He was looking at something, like sight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He was copying.
Copying, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
He talks about how he tried to tell his wife right before they got married. And he's like, he finally got the courage to say, I can't read. Then she just kind of thought like, you don't read much, you know, and she didn't probe, and they got married. And it wasn't until he was having to read to his 3-year-old girl that his wife finally realized, like, he can't read. And then it's kind of all kind of came back to her, she said, and, she kind of realized like why he had her help with so many projects and things like that. But eventually he did go, and, he got out of teaching, and he went to the local library and told the second person beyond his wife that he couldn't read, which was this person who, was a literacy coach at the local library. And timely enough, this being a week that Barbara Bush has passed, he said, I was 47 going on 48 when I saw Barbara Bush, the second lady of the U.S., talking about adult literacy on TV. It was her special cause.
Lady.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, at the time, and then he said, I'd never heard anybody talk about adult literacy before. I thought I was the only person in the world that was, in the situation I was in. So this story, and that motivated him to go to the library. But this story is just an amazing read of how this happened. And I guess I bring it up, like, how can I, you know, make this fit into the podcast? Really a question for you, Lissa. Do you think that this happens? Did you ever see this happen with a student in second, third, fourth grade who you think, you know, they're getting moved on, but I don't know that they can read?
It's hard for me to talk right now.
Yeah, it's an impactful story for sure.
It is. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I think a lot of... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's okay.
Russ, what about you? Do you think this happens?
Well, yes, I do. It put a lump in my throat too, that this person, the courage it must have taken to say, because, you know, you have to feel like a fraud every day, I think.
Right.
I would.
Yeah, he talks about that in the story.
And, you know, to think that, you know, I've been living this lie this whole time. I don't know how old he was. I haven't read the story yet. I'm going to read it. But to get to any age in life, I mean, everyone's literate, right? You think that, but you'd actually be surprised that there are a lot of adults that are just not literate. Right. And that's one of the reasons that Barbara Bush took it up.
I know of, I think the other side of the story is the people that do come in contact with somebody that is too old to not know how to read.
Right.
And the uncomfortableness that it leaves you as the person that realizes that, because it is such a personal thing. And you're right. They probably do wake up every day and they're faced with just shame and, you know, and so it's hard. I did have a student once. The reason why I got so choked up is because I did have a student once that I did realize could not read. And she, was everything you just described, this child, this young man growing up. I know he's an adult now, but just a very, you know, such a good student.
Right.
So, you know, and it is interesting in math how someone cannot know how to read.
He was good at math.
They're excellent in math. And
right.
so Anyway, and so it's hard when you're the other person and you, because it's something that you almost can't understand. I'm sure anybody that knows that this man went on through college and got married, well, it's, you know, it's hard. How could that even be possible? You think that it's not possible, but I do remember a really difficult time having to retain a student based on the fact that I felt that they couldn't read. And I was the math teacher.
I would say you probably did the right thing, though.
Well, it was just a really difficult, because having to look at the child and let them know that I felt like I knew that secret and that I just wanted to help. But then the parents were shocked. Everyone was shocked. Nobody, in fact, I probably looked a little crazy, you know, because how could you have made it to, it was a upper grade.
Yeah.
So how can you make it that far? So, I, you know, I do think that what we can all learn about this is just to make sure you have the hard conversations and get people the help they need, even if it's in a very private matter.
What is the number of U.S. adults? I just looked it up, and it was pretty astonishing. What is the number, according to the U.S. Department of Education, how many adults do you think in the United States can't read?
I'd say 5 million.
I don't know. Alyssa? I don't know. I can't even begin to guess.
32 million.
Golly.
I mean, gosh. Is that not 10%?
That's 10% of the population.
Right.
I don't know what it would be.
As adults even greater.
I wonder how many of them went through our school system.
I mean, you'd think all of them.
Because, probably. Yeah. I feel like today was Make Lisa Cry Day and y'all...
Yeah, we were both.
Nick
we were both.
Won.
Yeah, okay, I won for the record. Well, you know what the kids like? Fortnite.
God. They do.
They do. They love the Fortnite. And so.
And by kids, I mean Nick Ortega.
My kids. I played for a little bit, but the kids got too good. So I quit. So anyhow, I was on Twitter and there was a chat going on where this teacher consultant was talking about how to use Fortnite in the classroom to basically motivate the students. And I know it may sound gimmicky because that's the thing right now, but it's kind of what this guy does. He leads a chat where they have a lot of discussions about this, and it's not a gimmick. Like, he has like some legitimately good ideas that I think, you know, using alliteration, like stuff in from English and using math, quadratic formulas. And I did a full interview with him and my mind was blown. The video game Fortnite is all the rage and a major distraction for tweens and teens all over the country, but our guest in today's Bright Ideas segment is always looking for ways to leverage teen interest into tools for learning. Dennis Sheeran is the author of a brand new book called Hacking Mathematics, and he's also the host of the Make It Real chat, that's hashtag Make It Real on Twitter, and he's been bouncing ideas off his colleagues on how we can make Fortnite a teaching tool in the classroom. Dennis, I'm really excited to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I stumbled across your Make It Real chat, which I guess is a weekly chat on Twitter, correct?
It is. Yeah, every Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. for a half an hour.
Cool. And one of those topics was kind of addressing Fortnite. And anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about when I say Fortnite, it's a video game. It's on just about all platforms, Xbox, PC, and everything. And these kids just are falling in love with it, and they're playing it all the time. And essentially, they're little guys that get dropped onto an island, and they battle it out. And if you die, you're out of the game, and you start with 100 players, and it narrows down to one. So, in your mind, you felt like, you know, this is something my students or students are talking about. We need to address it, correct?
Absolutely. The first book that I wrote was called Instant Relevance, Using Today's Experience to Use to Teach Tomorrow's Lessons. And the key in there is that there are so many things that our kids are interested in and passionate about, and that we are personally interested and passionate about. And that is the path of least resistance to an engaging lesson opportunity. If our kids are already talking about something, they already want to do it, and they don't want to focus on your math classroom or your English classroom because all they want to do is play this game, then find a way to bring the game in, because you can probably extract a really valuable lesson from it and not just make it a way to, you know, attach interest, but really learn from it.
So when I first saw this, I was skeptical, because I started kind of going through the chat historically, and I was like, I don't know how you're going to get a lesson out of this video game. And then I started seeing some of the ideas that were bounced around, and I'm like, well, that's pretty brilliant. And so why don't you share with us some of the things that you've heard and you thought of yourself?
Sure. Yeah. See, I didn't really know anything about the game either. I just knew that kids were talking about it, even as much as my wife is an elementary school music teacher, and they're talking about it in her music classroom all the time. And I said, hey, let's ask them a few questions about it. Let's learn and see what this is about. So I saw some teachers looking at it and saying, I saw an English teacher say, let's look at the map in Fortnite. And every place in that map has a location that involves alliteration. Everything has two titles on it, Anarchy Acres or Tomato Town or Dusty Depot. And let's talk about alliteration. Let's talk about naming some other places and learn about that in our English classroom. That's one little way that you can actually use that as an example in your class. Others, we're talking more less specifically about the actual lesson plate and a little bit more about the idea behind why kids like this game. Is it about the competition or is it about the team building? Is it about the violence? And is that something we need to talk about? So we started developing some ideas for lessons about really talking about our current world and society and social violence and what games do and don't do with regard to violence and what they should or shouldn't do. What is their responsibility? All the way through math lessons of trying to calculate and find and analyze the information from statistics inside the game to using quadratics to kill, what are those little bush people things or whatever they are? I don't even know. But so there are people using this in a lot of different ways within their classrooms. I even saw one that I really liked, which we piggybacked into another lesson, which was looking at the geology inside and the geography inside the game and saying, where could this be if this was in a real place? And then mapping that to geography lessons they'd done in science class and see where in the world it might actually be. And then we transferred that to a five-location game inside the I don't even know if you've ever played this. It's called GeoGuessr. It's Google Street View, dropping you in the middle of nowhere and asking you to guess where you are.
Oh, that's
so
neat.
It turned into an activity where kids are now guessing where they are, but using knowledge that it could be a place inside this game because of its geography, geology, and take a look at it and see what was neat about that.
So you were talking about the quadratics model. Can we drill down on that a little bit? Like, how would that work?
Well, I had a teacher say that they were good, that they looked at it and say, "Hey, I'm going to use this for quadratic." So the shots and the things that you launch inside the game, I guess, leave a tracer behind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, stopping that, pausing it, screenshotting it, and saying, first, can we model this path? Can we actually come up with a model for it? So we could take an image of it, take that image, import it into Desmos, which is a free online graphing calculator program that allows image input, and then graph it from there and see who can come up with the best model for it. Then go even farther and say, is the game realistic? Is it following the rules for physics? Is it graphing what would probably happen if something was thrown or launched? Or is it doing something that's unrealistic? And so should you change your approach to the game based on the unrealistic mathematical assumptions in the game?
I just love this because I know kids. I have teens and tweens, and I know they love the game. And I know they're not interested in quadratics. But I bet you, if you did that, you would totally grab their attention, and it would make it that much easier. I saw another person suggest, and I know you aren't as familiar with the game, but essentially you start off on this island, and there's this storm that's constantly closing in on you, making the area of play smaller. And somebody said, you know, you might be able to do something with, do storm circles always close at the same rate? And there's probably some radius and diameter lessons in there as well.
There are, yeah, and that's the cool thing, too. I didn't know about the storm circles because I've never actually played the game and how it closes in your space, but at minimum, it's really cool because when you close in a space at a certain radius, you change the, like, obviously the area of play, and people think that you change it by the same amount, but you don't. And proportionally, you might, think about the difference between a large and an extra large pizza. When you add, you know, 2-inch diameter around the outside of the pizza, even farther or radius outside, you get a lot more pizza. So it's kind of a cool thing to think that they're closing it in, but at the same time, using that not specifically and not so directly as the lesson, but using it as a vehicle for the lesson, where teachers would say, you know what, we have these circles closed, these storms closing in every 3 minutes. Well, how about I apply that to my actual lesson? I've got 45 minutes, and I've got a big question, and I've got some things that I want to refine down and get to I want to get to a point. I have an objective. How can I use the model of closing out these storm circles every 3 minutes in my classroom to make the experience more like Fortnite and not necessarily a Fortnite lesson?
And so why is this so important to reach kids on this level?
You know, it's funny that you asked that because for the longest time, I thought I was doing like the best job of teaching. I taught high school math for 13 years before I moved back to New Jersey from Illinois and started a career as an administrator. And one of the things that I was sometimes the most proud of was that lesson that I had constructed that I could explain so clearly that I'm sure the kids would understand it by the time they left. And what I realize now is that my kids didn't even need to be in the room. I could have delivered that lesson to a computer and they could have watched it on the computer. If I was that good at delivering the lesson, they didn't need to be there. So that's what's happened. Our world is now filled with excellent lessons that people have delivered to a computer that we can transfer to our kids. They're watching and learning anything on their own. So if I want to just deliver content to them, they don't need to come to me to do it. So it's important that we make our classroom experiences engaging and relevant to our kids. That's the difference. We are not the sages who know everything anymore, who need to transfer information over to the next generation for posterity. We are now the creators of experiences that our students can engage in and create a desire to learn. And if we can attack that from the position of what do our kids like to do? What's important to them? What matters to them? What matters to me? Because if something matters to me and I have a good relationship with my kids, then it's going to matter to them too. That, like, how can I look deeply inside that so that I can create an experience that requires them to learn the things that I want them to learn? That's why it's important.
Is that pretty much what the Make It Real chat is about weekly? Is you know, the information's there, but how do we make it real for our students?
Yeah, it is. We go back and forth on the Make It Real chat a lot from specific topics like Fortnite and relevantly using it in class. I did something last year on fidget spinners right at the height of its popularity. People were banning them from their classroom. And instead, we wrote a whole set of lessons and put it on a hyperdoc and put it on my website and talked about how we can engage kids with fidget spinners before it's too late. You try to fidget spinner lesson right now, yeah. It's not going to work. Kids
cool
don't care.
Yeah.
You know? So how long is Fortnite going to last? I have no idea. There's probably going to be another game that comes out that transfers kids away. It's not necessarily the next big Minecraft EDU thing where it's going to rebuild and become part of a makerspace community and become part of a whole movement, but it's something that's interesting to them. So you've got to use it now while it's available. But I'll go back and forth as well to being able to talk about good teaching. So even tonight, or my most recent chat, I know it's tonight, we're talking about like spring cleaning, just because it's that time of year for us. So, but what in that idea is, what are we cleaning out of our educator's closet? What are the things we don't want to use anymore? What are we making room for? What are some new things that we wanted to try? And what are some things that we just recently found again that we should dust off because we really liked? You know, that analogy of cleaning out our own closets a little bit too. So it's a lot about good teaching and good teaching techniques, but when something comes up that really is important that we can try to grab onto the momentum of, then we definitely move into that area, which ties in.
Your new book, Hacking Mathematics, is available on Amazon. It's 10 Problems That Need Solving. What's it all about?
Well, I wanted to steer away from a list of tips and tricks. That's not necessary anymore. Again, if you want tips and tricks, you can go on YouTube, you can go on the internet, you can find tips and tricks for teaching things. So the Hacking Math book is not about that. It's about the big ideas that I see in teaching right now and in teaching mathematics that need to grow and evolve because of the community and the world in which we live. So there are ideas about how you can really engage kids from the moment class gets started with something that interests them, how we can change our questioning techniques so that those questions actually create a need for our learning, how you can engage with the online math teacher community, those passionate teachers who are changing the world, to all the different things that we can do, from the technology we can use, to the way we can communicate with parents, to the way we actually understand our own teaching. So the big ideas inside Hacking Math are a lot less about, you know, this is how you can factor quadratics better, this is how you can add fractions better, and a lot more about what is it that you are struggling most with as a teacher in today's world, and let's see if we can fix those problems.
You talked about changing your questions. Can you throw one at me? Like, can you kind of give me an example of what you mean by that?
I'm looking at what are we doing with math in general that is hamstringing our kids. And so when I look at the questions that we ask, we very often will look at a situation and say, you know, what's the answer to this question? Or instead of saying, like, what's the answer to this question? Or here's a problem I need you to solve. And if you get through this problem, then eventually, you know, you might apply it to something. And that's not where I'm going with that. With questioning, I want to encourage my students to be able to develop what's called the productive struggle through the mathematic learning process. So I want my teachers to pose a question for them and quite literally to be less helpful. The fifth hack in the book is be less helpful and ask more questions. Hmm. We treat math class like it's a MASH triage unit out there where everybody's coming in with all of these mathematical wounds and we need to figure out who has the biggest problem, who has the smallest problem, how can we fix it the fastest? And we're always giving kids answers. We're running over to them and saying, I'm looking at your work and this is what you did wrong, fix this. Or we let them get halfway through a question and then we answer it for them instead of letting them develop the question themselves. So the key here is developing a set of questions that will promote discourse and feedback in our classroom to create what I call riverbend moments inside of our math class instead of finish lines. So when I see my students struggling with a problem, but I understand the concept that they're learning, to go to listen, to hear where they are in that concept, and then to ask a question that can take them through to look farther, to say, what is it that you did already that worked? What is it you did that didn't work? So how can you take what you didn't work and try something new in place of it? And develop the set of questioning and procedure skills for them that allow them to think through problems instead of just get to the end point.
If someone wants to keep up with you, you know, where do you like to normally hang out? Are you on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere?
I'm mostly on Twitter, actually. So you can follow me on Twitter at MathDennisNJ. That's MathDennisNJ. And that's Dennis with one N, which I officially should have changed my name 2 years ago because every time people asked me my name, it was always Dennis with one N.
Right.
You know? And so I'm there. That's the same handle for Instagram, which I just picked up. you can find more information about me and more of my posts and my writing and my lessons and my activities in the math that I share on my website, which is DennisSheeran.com. And both of the books are available on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble.
All right. Well, Dennis Sheeran, we appreciate your time. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Yeah. Yeah, I love to.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Music.
Why is that? That's a first, maybe.
Yeah. I'll get philosophical for you for a minute here. I think music is what makes us human. I think music is humanity. I don't see an animal making music. I see an animal making sound. People may say birds sing, but they don't sing. They make a sound. We make music. We think about music. And when we want to hear something that we can't hear, we invent an instrument that can make the sound. And I think that the overriding principle of humanity is music. It's about problem solving. It's about individualism. And it's about coming together in perfection so that you can actually, you know, perform together without error. And I think that if you could teach one thing, I think that would probably be able to get us through everything else we need.
Wow. That's deep. I got to hand it to you. Next question. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching? I think, coping skills and coping with failure especially. There's a bigger movement now, which I absolutely am fully behind and appreciate, which is to treat failure like the learning opportunity that it is instead of the end point that it has been and the competitive place that it was. We need to teach our kids how to understand and reflect and cope and then be able to make positive moves in the right direction. And that isn't being taught enough from kindergarten through the top.
What does every child deserve?
Time to think. I think every child deserves some time to think. I was recently at a teacher workshop where I wasn't presenting, and I figured I was going to try to cram as much into one day as I could because I was only there for a day, and I went to 6 sessions on some really cool stuff, and by the end of the day, I was exhausted, but loved learning everything I'd learned because I'd chosen to go to it, but I was tired at the end of the day, and then realized, holy cow, like, 8-year-olds do this every day.
Mm-hmm. I've been there.
Like 10-year-olds do this every day. High school kids with emotions and hormones that are out of control do this every day.
Right.
When do we give them time? And I think every child deserves time to think and to process and to reset. So I think they need more of that.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
The biggest challenge for today's educators is to relinquish control. I think we need to give up the fact that our classroom isn't ours, because when our kids aren't in it, nothing's happening. So it's theirs. We've got to give up some of our control. I recently had a story of a teacher who said, actually it was one of my wife's music colleagues, who said, I got a third grade kid who just won't sing in class, so I sent him to the office. I'm like, are you kidding me? You sent a third grade kid to the office because he wouldn't sing?
Right.
Like, how about you find a better way to get him to sing? And you talk to him about what he loves singing instead of sending him out as a discipline problem for not doing what you told him he was supposed to do. I think we need to give up control in our classrooms, and in a positive and surprising way, we're actually going to gain control of our students' learning.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Well, that's funny. What's the best gift to give an educator? It's probably the same thing that I want to give kids. It's time. But not just summer, where everybody's like, oh, you have some time in the summer. Time to do things daily. I look at the world when I first started teaching, and there was not a computer on my desk, you know, and then all of a sudden there was, and then all of a sudden I'm emailing everybody, and then all of a sudden everything I have to do has to be online in lessons and grade books. I think I would restructure the school day significantly to provide teachers and students with the time that would make them more effective teachers and learners.
Which teacher changed your life?
You know, there's been a lot of teachers in my life who have been positive influences for me. My father was a teacher and a guidance counselor when I was growing up, and so I kind of always knew I wanted to be in a school. I wanted to be a teacher. I wasn't sure if it was going to be math or it was going to be music. That's how I met my wife. And to think back and to say, you know, which teacher really made that difference in my life? I'm going to have to say one of my high school English teachers. Her name is Mary Hassenplug, and she's on Twitter too. And her Twitter handle is Do Your Homework 21, or Do Your HW 21. Mm-hmm. But she was my English teacher, and I was a math kid. And, you know, back in the day when we thought we had math kids versus English kids, she brought out in me like a desire to write. She brought out in me a desire to express myself. But she also allowed my math side to become part of my creative written side. And what's interesting is that was in high school. When I moved back to New Jersey and took my first administrative position, I took it in a school where she was the English supervisor, and we became colleagues.
Oh, that's really
And we've been colleagues and friends ever since, and I think that she's had one of the most long-standing effects on my life as a colleague, as a teacher, as a mentor, and as an example.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Pen.
Right.
You might not expect that from a math person either.
No.
But I don't believe in erasing mistakes. If you want to make a mistake, erase it and fix it, you might as well just transcribe a textbook down and have it look perfectly, because that's what you're doing. I believe if you can write something in pen and you make a mistake and you know it, you should be able to circle it or highlight it or identify it and then continue from that point with the correction so that you can track your thinking. And something permanent allows that to happen, and something temporary does not.
All right, Dennis Sheeran, the book is Hacking Mathematics, and the Twitter chat is Make It Real. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us. It sounds like you've got a ton of just really great ideas to reach kids.
Well, thanks for having me, and I hope that we'll be able to stay in touch and keep growing together as we go.
Sounds good. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortega, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!